like talking about heaven and talking about hell very much. I really don't, for a variety of reasons. One is, I want to be in a relationship with God and enjoying this moment right now, not holding out or waiting for something much, much later on. And on top of that, much of the discussion or confusion about the future just doesn't sit well with me. The way I hear heaven talked about, it's kind of like being dipped in candy, and that doesn't really excite me all that much. In the same way, people who are excited to talk about hell just seem to be unbalanced, and the idea of hell doesn't really appeal to me. It doesn't excite me. I don't like talking about it, and yet there's something here that's really healthy and helpful for us to take a look at. We're going to do some theology today. Theology, meaning from two Greek words, thea, from theos, Greek word for God, logi, logos, word, or study. Theology is the study of God. Very few of us ever actually engage in the study of God. We look for the verification of my God. We don't actually jump into deep waters. We don't actually open ourselves up to truth that may be distasteful for us, for something we haven't thought of. Most of us, our search for God is searching for a system or a being that is agreeable with us. And the idea of there being a hell and God somehow being pro-hell is just very, very disagreeable for us. And some of the classic questions, how can God send anybody to hell? And how does this happen? And it's as if there's a bunch of people that have a board in front of them that God creates before them, and he puts a bunch of buttons and says, go ahead, choose which button you like. And he's just waiting to see whether or not you choose the right button. In case you choose the wrong spirituality, the wrong belief, it's like, I get electrocuted. And so as the reason goes, well, how can somebody be, God just send somebody to hell who has that happen? And that's a very inaccurate perception of what happens with hell that we're going to look at today. We're going to look at what it means for the very character of God to be wrapped up in being both graceful, being full of grace, being full of mercy, being full of love, and having a place that exists under his purview that's referred to as hell. Now, the strangest and most difficult thing to talk about is that the one person that you would think that you have as an ally for hell being a bad idea can't be your ally, and that person is Jesus. Everybody believes that Jesus is the epitome of love. It doesn't matter if you reject him. It doesn't matter if you're a Buddhist, a basic spiritualist, or whatever you are. There isn't anybody who wouldn't say that Jesus is a good, loving guy. He's a good moral example. Everybody believes that. And everybody, even if you don't believe everything he says, everything he claims about himself, everybody would say that Jesus is a good teacher. So he's a good teacher. He's a good moral guy, all these things. And yet, the backbone of the teaching about a place called hell in the Bible actually comes from Jesus. Jesus talked more about hell than he did about heaven. In fact, if you add up in the entire Bible, that is 62 books plus the four books that actually have his teachings in it, if you add it up in those 62 books of the Bible, all the teachings on hell combined, it wouldn't equal Jesus's teachings on hell. Now, this is really wild. This is really strange unless you see Jesus dwelling in the midst of this tension of grace and hell. The Bible says that Jesus came full of grace and truth. Very few people are people of grace, able to give slack, and people of truth, able to say it the way it is. Most of us err one side or the other. We're truth, or we're grace. Oh, it's okay, it's okay. But Jesus says it is full of grace and full of truth. And so the study of God, God's character, is found in both of these elements, the elements of grace and the elements in the presence of an actual hell. Now let's take a look at one of Jesus's teachings here. On this comes from the book of Luke, chapter 16. Many people refer to this as a parable. A parable was a story that Jesus made up to give true-to-life information. He wanted to get truth across. He'd make up a story. The information or the truth wasn't made up, but the story was. And this is, some people believe to be a parable. Some people actually believe this to be a true story, but it's one of his deeper treatises on heaven and hell, the grace of God, the suffering and punishment many of us sense. And here's what he says, Luke 16, verse 19. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed and with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried, and in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes, saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side, and he called out, "Father Abraham," Abraham being the father of the Jewish nation. So the symbol here, the symbolism of being right beside God, right in the heavens. "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things and Lazarus in like manner bad things, but now he's comforted here and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who had passed from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." Most people believe this to be a parable, a story Jesus made up. Many people, many scholars, actually believe this is not a parable because it doesn't actually fit the paradigm of a parable. First of all, it doesn't say Jesus said a story. It doesn't say that he made up a story like it often does in parables. Another issue here is there's actually a name used in this, and none of Jesus' parables is there ever a name that's being used. So some people believe that Jesus is actually drawing on his divinity and talking about a true life situation. Whether he's drawing on his divinity, talking about a true life situation that he was aware of, or whether or not this is a story that he made up to communicate truth, there is a lot here for us to chew on. This is actually one of the favorite verses for people who may believe in a redistribution of wealth, or people who may be socialists, who might just be against somebody who has a lot of nice things. So it looks like, hey, we got a guy who's hurting here. The guy is so hurting, he's looking for dogs to lick his sores. That's how hurting is. And he goes to heaven, he goes to get nice things, and here's a guy who's clothed in purple robes. He's got the finest of clothing. He's all got all the good stuff, and he goes down, 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 down. So see, there's going to be a reversal of fortune in the future. That's not what Jesus is saying here. He's not saying if you've got a lot, you're going to have nothing. If you have nothing, you're going to have a lot. It's not an automatic reversal of fortune. What he's doing is he's likening conditions that we have here on this earth to conditions that last into eternity. So when I am in pain, when I am in difficulty, it is a slice of hell that I'm experiencing. When I'm having pleasure, when things are going great, it is a slice of heaven that I'm experiencing. So it's fascinating, the things that are included here. One of the things that's talked about here is that nobody goes or communicates from one to the other. There is a spirit realm. None of us can fully understand it, but there is a spirit realm. And Jesus says if anybody gets visited by a dead relative or somebody talks to you that you think was your former this or that, it wasn't them at all. Nobody can communicate from the other side. Doesn't mean you're not being communicated to. You could be communicated to through something, some spirit in the spirit realm that is taking on the characteristics or voice or feeling of a lost one, but a loved one never is able to communicate with you. There's a chasm, and you can never communicate with a loved one. There's an utter chasm. Can we just say right now we're getting into weird stuff? Let's just take a big breath. Man, let's unpucker that butt for a little bit. My goodness, you know. Heavyweight question. How can you have a discussion about hell without talking about these things? You have to, as opposed to things just devolving into some debate, into some he said, she said, how can this be, how can that be? I actually believe we see in this story and throughout the Bible that grace and hell actually are not opposed to one another. Grace and hell actually live very harmoniously with one another. In fact, if God did not have a nature of grace, there at the same time would not be the reality of a hell. And if there wasn't a hell, or the very existence of a hell, rather, also communicates his graceful presence. Now, let's talk about that. Four ideas that happen when grace and hell come. And by the way, when we talk about hell, I'm not going to get into today all of the intramural debates that take place. There's a lot of things that people are interested in talking about that I'm just really not interested in talking about, like what happens with people who've never heard, what happens with somebody who's born in a different time period, what happens with it. Those are all great, great questions, all place and time for those things. But you need to realize that people who have a heart for God and fully and wholeheartedly believe every word in this have some different outtakes and viewpoints on those topics. So I don't want to get into those various topics as valuable as they may be. I want to get into just why is it this place seems to exist? And many of us have opinions about this place that are just wrong. It's obviously very uncomfortable, but to simply refer to hell as a fireball really is a little premature and uneducated, because the Bible also refers to hell as a place of darkness. How can fire and darkness exist at the same time? It doesn't. We're not really sure exactly what's literal, exactly what's figurative. We knew Jesus looked at things in his society and he likened them to eternal realities. The physical world regularly described and was a link to the spiritual world. He looked in a valley that I've seen over outside of Jerusalem, the Valley of Gehenna. Gehenna is actually the Greek word for hell. He sees the Valley of Gehenna, where the refuse was brought, and they would burn the refuse over and over and over and over again. So perhaps he's, and you can see that still today, they don't burn it there. It's like a pit, a big pit that's empty at this point. So there's something about that he said it goes on and on and on, and there's discomfort for a long, 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 long time. But we're not sure exactly what parts are literal, what parts are figurative, but we do know this. I do know this, and I'm hoping to help you see this too. Grace and hell actually need one another to exist. Why is that? First way they exist together is that love predicates choice. Love demands that there is a choice. Not the choice that many of us feel, like the choice of, okay, which door should I go through? What religion should I choose? I will choose this door. Oh no, a grizzly bear, I'm eaten and dead. No, not that kind of choice. Well, Islam, Christianity, not that kind of choice. The kind of choice that I have with my dog. You know, I have a dog. His name is Winston. He's 110 pounds right now. He's very, very aggravating, very, very frustrating. He is pooping still in the house. The only thing I can say about it is we're not going to change his food because it comes out pretty solid. Still pooping in the house. And by the way, don't be sending your emails on how to solve this. I've had a lot of dogs. I know all the techniques. I've done the techniques. I'm not asking you to solve my problem. I'm just saying my dog is really bothering me. He's still pooping in the house. He's still chewing things. But you know what? I would take him over a little mechanical dog any day. You know, I've had those dogs. My parents gave me one because they wouldn't give me a real dog. They gave me a little mechanical dog, arf, 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 and then it would do a backflip. And arf, arf, arf. Now, that dog never disappointed me. That dog never bothered me at all. And it had no choice. It had no soul. Love means that there must be choice. When God loves us, and the Bible says God is love, and Jesus is universally known as a loving person because, according to the Bible, he was God himself, so of course that's how he would be known. When there is love, there must be a choice, and so as frustrating as Winston is, my goodness, when I'm watching television and he's up on the couch, and yes, I let him up on the couch, and when his head is in my lap, life does not get any better, because you cannot have love when there is not choice. And God has given us the choice to serve him, to follow him, to love him, or to not serve him, to follow him and love him. And that choice isn't simply a right, wrong choice. That choice brings with it numerous ramifications. the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, 17 to 20, we see in this Old Testament book, the beginning of the Bible, we see this, this heartbeat of the character of God, the theology, if you will, of God. Here's what it says. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. I set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life that you and your offspring may live loving the Lord your God. So you choose your choice. And whatever you choose is going to have natural ramifications. This is what love does. Love woos, love includes, love wants, but ultimately love cannot force. My friend and author Irwin McManus talks about it this way. Says, hell is not a declaration that God does not love us. Hell is a declaration that God will not force us to love him. Why do we think that everybody wants to be with God in heaven? Why would we think that? I mean, if someone doesn't want the fullness of God's identity right now, why do we think that they would want the fullness of God's identity for eternity? Doesn't make sense. It might be similar to Lazarus here and the rich man. The rich man, really, he really doesn't want God. He doesn't want to be with God. He just doesn't want the pain. I've got an old seminary professor who did a whole study, and he really believes that in America, the valuing and belief in a hell went south as soon as anesthesia was invented, because as soon as anesthesia was invented, we were able to control our pain, and Americans became much more interested in controlling pain than actually seeking relationship and understanding the divine, because now we could control our pain. And we actually see this here with the rich man. The rich man isn't saying, oh, I want to be with you, Father Abraham. He's saying, send Lazarus down to just dip his finger in the water for my tongue. I just don't want the pain. Have him, tell him to go tell my loved ones not to come down here, because this is a very, very uncomfortable place. But it's a place that the natural ramification of choices have brought it. You know, in the physical realm, there are things that communicate in the physical realm what the spiritual realm is like. In a couple weeks, we're going to talk about sex. Let me just give you a little precursor to this. What's powerful about sex is that when you have physical intercourse, you are being physically locked together, and it mirrors, in the spiritual sense, a man and a woman being united and committed to one another forever, being spiritually one. And the physical connection is being a mirror of their spiritual oneness forever. And actually, the orgasm that happens in that, it actually is great. It's exhilarating physically, because when a relationship is going great, it should be exhilarating and amazing physically, amazing emotionally, amazing spiritually. And here's the crazy thing. The reason why God is so pro that kind of relationship, even though many of us are not going to get married, maybe shouldn't get married, but the reason why that is so awesome is because God has that physical relationship here on earth mirroring the relationship he has with us. Jesus is referred to as the bridegroom, as the bridegroom. His followers are referred to as the bride of Christ. And so what it is God actually unites himself with us. He unites himself with us and connects himself with us. And how is that described? What is that like? Now hang with me. Some of you are going to be really disgusted by this, but don't be. Don't be. Heaven, the descriptions many of us have for heaven is something I'm personally not interested in. I'm not interested in an eternal choir practice. You know, big deal, like, woo, yeah, woo, singing songs all day, wonderful. Or, or stroking a harp up in the clouds or whatever, you know. Yeah, that doesn't capture my imagination at all. But I tell you what, oneness with God, oneness in pure relationship that is literally orgasmic, I could take that forever. Why has God created... So why do we all do sex? Why do we want sex? Because it feels good. And I'll tell you what, when you realize that God has instituted sex to be a physical experience of what's happening in the spiritual realm, it makes me realize that's probably what heaven is like. A 24/7 orgasm in relationship with God. Now, let me tease this out a little bit more. One of the things that all of us universally say, and I do mean that, I think that is the most exhilarating time that we're alive. It is amazing. It is, man, if God is going to give us the greatest thing of this world forever in heaven, if that's where you're going, that's what it's going to be like. But it's going to happen because of the relationship, because you being committed and in relationship with Him. I know we have a lot of different opinions on sex in here, and not only different opinions, a lot of different practices. But nonetheless, one thing all of us, I'm sure, would agree with is nobody should force themselves sexually on anybody. It just shouldn't happen. No one should do that. There shouldn't be that force. And probably all of us agree, too, that you know, if there is sex, both people should sort of like each other. We probably all agree that. So the idea of forcing something or being, we're not, why is that? Because we all have some form of desire for love, and choice must be involved where both equally choose. God would never force you to have intimacy with Him and violate your choice because it could not be love. To do that would be break all the laws of intimacy. And likewise, if we are choosing to not want Jesus, to not want God, to not have His life, what makes us think that we would ever choose to be with Him forever? Our choice shows us what we really want, what we really love, and hell is the absence of all of the presence of God, the way we understand it. And yet we choose, if we don't want Him, we choose everything else inversely. Love, and His love predicates this. His love must have this to be. And severity precedes mercy. Severity precedes mercy. We talk about the mercy of God, the love of God, these kind of things. How do we know there's a mercy? We know there's a mercy because there's a severity. Why is there a forgiveness? There's a forgiveness because there's an offense. We can't have the mercy of God unless there is a justifiable and verifiable punishment that's deserved. The very mercy of God is a recognition that there are severe consequences. And this isn't anything that should make anybody excited, by the way. I get really concerned when people get excited about talking about hell or someone like damning somebody to hell or go to hell. It is weird to me how passionate people are in defending this and making this part of their identity. I'm telling you what, if you're thrilled about the idea of hell, you need therapy. I'm not thrilled about the idea of it. I'm not. But in it, I see something about the depth and the character of God, and its presence makes me appreciate the mercy of God that I'm experiencing right now. In fact, the reason why all of us right now aren't experiencing the severity of God, we are experiencing difficulties for sure, but the reason we're not experiencing the severity of God is the very mercy of God, because while God oversees all that is happening in the entire cosmos, oversees the establishment of hell and what's taking place there, He doesn't want anyone to go there. He doesn't want anybody by their choice to form a love affair with anything other than Him that would then later have natural consequences. In fact, in the book of 2 Peter, it says this. It's over here, I think. There it is. The Lord is not slow to fulfill His promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. A lot of stuff I'm not going to go into right now, but notice how this whole thing leads off. He's patient, not wishing any to perish. One of the reasons why we're unsure of hell is none of us have actually been there right now. We haven't gone there right now because God is not wanting anybody to go there. Anybody, if we're choosing anything other than God, God doesn't want us to have the natural consequence of that. He's holding out. He's waiting. The amazing thing is we don't give anybody the mercy that God gives us. My goodness, we get so upset just driving to work. We get upset someone cutting us off. We get upset one little thing doesn't go our way. And yet we expect God to never get upset. We expect God to constantly turn a blind eye to indiscretions, to selfishness. God's very goodness prescribes that there is justice. for him to be good means that there has to be justice. The reason why we get upset when somebody gets off scot-free in a charge because of a loophole, or because when somebody has a lot of money, they can get the best legal defense, or when somebody, somehow escapes bail, or somebody doesn't get caught, or something. The reason we get so upset about that is because we get upset when there isn't justice. And if God isn't pro-justice, then he's just not good. He's just not good. Anytime there is something that is not right, something should be done about it. The reason that God is good is because he is just. It's because he's just. There has to be an accounting for the ways that we have offended a holy and pure and loving God who's actually created us. Should I get upset when somebody cuts me off, let alone if I actually created the car and created the driver and then he cut me off? There's a justice element that is present in the reality of hell, because right now on this earth, not all of us receive justice. We just don't. People who diss God and do everything that is offensive to other people and hurtful to other people, there's not a lot of justice here in this world. And if I expected that this world to contain all that was just and there not to be some justice measure on the other side of death, then God would not be just, because obviously justice isn't happening in this world. And part of the good thing about this is this enables me to be me and let God be God. I don't want to surmise what happens with people who haven't heard. I don't want to surmise, who goes, who doesn't. I've got some personal favorites I hope that are in hell, but I know when I think about that, that I am personally wrong in doing that, because those things are God's job, they're not my job. In the book of Romans chapter 12, 9 to 10, it says this: Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Some of us in here perhaps have as our job delivering justice. And the Bible does speak about there being people who are entrusted with the need to uphold a civil society and ensure justice happens. And when you're on duty, if you're a judge, you're behind the bench, your job, actually before God, even if you don't believe in God, you are still commissioned by him to be delivering of justice here on this earth. So there's something for that. But for all the rest of us, and even for all of us who have that job, but outside of our 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week, whatever it is, my job is not to deliver justice. And what this does, this frees me up to be merciful and loving. That's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be merciful and loving and not be concerned about balancing the scales, because God says, vengeance is mine. God says, I am just. I am a macro God. I see the whole picture. I understand everything. Nobody is going to get away with anything. I am somehow going to make this right. And so what this does for me is I realize, okay, I need to stop judging people. I need to stop personally sending people to hell in my mind. I need to stop trying to make people feel something when they should be feeling it, but they're not feeling it because their choices are causing them to be hard. No, it's my opportunity to be loving, graceful, and forgiving, and leave ultimate justice to God. And goodness enables that to happen. Goodness prescribes that there is justice, and knowing that there is justice helps me. Helps me to be actually good. When we make these choices, and we naturally take on the things that we have chosen, and then we naturally have all the ramifications from those things, we actually take on a new identity. We become somebody different. We actually enter into our preferred reality. As I said before, this guy here that we're looking at, he just doesn't like the discomfort of Hades. He's not really wanting to be with God. He just doesn't want the discomfort. If we don't want God here in this life, why do we think that we would want him in all of its fullness later on? Hell is simply the fullness of your prescribed reality. It's the fullness of the ramifications of your free choices, your preferred reality. It's all of it coming to bear. I'm going to show a clip of somebody who is living in a preferred reality, and while we do, we're going to have the opportunity to take up an offering. And while we do that, it's a physical way for us to engage with God in his spiritual value of generosity. If you're newer here today, you're so freaked out right now, but we're glad you haven't run out of here right now. Wonderful. Thank you for not raising your finger at me. Wonderful. Just feel no pressure. Let the bag pass by. But for those of us who are been around here, we know this is the way we run after people. This is the way we bless people. And so we're going to have the opportunity to be generous. And while we do that, we're going to take a look at somebody who's an example of creating their own preferred reality. Charlie Sheen right now is very vocal with his beliefs. He's very vocal with the choices he's made. And I find it interesting how many people are really bothered by what he's saying here. I certainly would be bothered if he's acting this way because of drugs. That'd be a bummer. It could be that he is bipolar, has some mental disorder that's kicking in. You know, that would be a bummer for sure. But I just show this to illustrate. Here's a person in and of where he is. He is living his preferred reality, and it's by his choice. And actually, a lot of us in here are really bothered by it because if you had the ability, you would live that preferred reality too. If you had the ability to have two women called the goddesses living with you and meeting all of your sexual needs, if you had the ability to have millions and millions of dollars and have it not affect you, if you had the ability to say anything you want and not affect your quality of life, you very well may choose that reality. You may actually go to that place. That's what hell is. It's the fullness of my reality. It's the fullness of the full ramifications of my choice of wanting anything other than God, even if I don't understand what all those choices are. C.S. Lewis, the great thinker from Oxford, put it this way. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell chose it. I can choose right now to say, "God, I just want you. I want a being that I can't fully understand and I can't fully wrap my mind around, yet you are mysterious to me. You are deep. I want what you want for my life because I want you. Not because I want to escape flames or escape pain. No, I want you. That's what I want. I want you." Lazarus doesn't want God, or the rich man doesn't want God. He doesn't want anybody to feel pain. He doesn't want anybody to feel the natural ramifications. He says, notice, he's still bossing around the poor guy. Have you noticed that? The fullness of his reality, such as on the earth, he felt superior, he felt high and exalted, but it just says that the Lazarus, the poor guy, kind of sat outside the gate having his sores licked and stuff like that. We don't see a picture of him actually bossing him around then, but he's around. But now, the fullness of him, he's bossing around, he's trying to boss him around even on the other side of the curtain. Saying, "Hey, send that little loser servant to put his finger in water and send him back to my family. Send him. I don't want them to have this difficulty. I don't want them." And Jesus says, "Hey, look, they didn't listen to Moses, the prophets, all the scriptures that spoke to my identity and my relationship with them. They're not going to speak with him. They're not going to listen. In fact, they wouldn't even listen if somebody came back from the dead." Actually giving a precursor to one of the most miraculous things only God himself could do is actually raise him from the dead. But do you notice here? Raise himself from the dead. Notice here that the rich man who's in torment, his preferred reality still does not include God. It does not include God. When I don't want the fullness of God, it's unreasonable, unjust, irrational, and actually abusive to think that I will get anything of the goodness of God forced on me. Doesn't work that way. Talking about hell is a difficult thing. It's tiring. I'm tired right now talking about it. Very tired. I know it communicates something about God, about the beauty of his mystery. I know it communicates something about his justice. I know it communicates something about the stakes are very high here on earth for how I follow him, how I honor him, and how I make it so as few possible people as possible will go to a place like that. It does, it compels me, but it tires me, it's grueling. That's one of the reasons why most of us don't want to look at it. We don't want to think about it. That's just siphoning off to all those weird people who represent stupid abusive religion, and it's gone and bygone. Let's just be enlightened and move on. And having us think, if we believe in justice, if we believe in goodness, if we believe in mercy, if we have to have some mechanism for eternal justice. It has to be there, or else God isn't good, unless there isn't any mercy. And what this does, it, while it tires me, it also awakens me personally to the grace of God, to the mercy of God. I don't look at this and say, oh, God's not graceful because people are there right now. I look at this and say, man, why am I not there right now? Why? That's amazing. Generations ago, there was a classic message given by a guy by the name of Jonathan Edwards, who was the actually founder of Princeton. And he actually gave a sermon. He was not a captivating speaker in terms of his delivery. It is said that he actually read his sermons in a monotone, high, squealy voice. And yet oftentimes when he would speak, maybe it was because people didn't have other stimuli from media, such as iPods and stuff like that. People would actually fall over. They'd actually fall over in his church over the immensity and the heaviness of what he was talking about. One of those sermons is likened to starting what's referred to as one of the Great Awakenings, actually a spiritual revival that actually swept through the northeastern colonies in the 1800s. And here's a section of that little story, of that sermon that he actually gave to people who were sitting in a church like we're sitting in one right now. He said this, "However you may have reformed your life in many things and may have had religious affections and may keep up a form of religion in your families and closets and in the house of God, it is nothing but his mere pleasure that keeps you from being this moment swallowed up in everlasting destruction. However unconvinced you may now be of the truth of what you hear, by and by you will be fully convinced of it. You have offended him infinitely more than ever a stubborn rebel did his prince, and yet it is nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. It is to be ascribed to nothing else that you did not go to hell last night and that you awoke again in this world after you closed your eyes to sleep. And there's no other reason to be given why you have not dropped into hell since you arose in the morning, but that God's hand has held you up. I can be affixed on the awfulness and the terribleness in terms of the severity of hell, or I can also be affixed on the grace and mercy of God. God is slow to anger. God is not wanting any to perish. But God is very clear to communicate this reality, not just to show us the depth of his character, but to also perhaps make us shake the cobwebs out of our head and say, what am I doing? What am I doing? Maybe there's something right now that's happening in your life. There's not going to be a thing that's going to damn you to hell. No, no, no. But it's going to be the thing that's indicating that there's a fracture in your relationship with God or an absence of your relationship with God. And the best way to respond is just make that better. Go to your spouse. Go to your spouse in contrition and ask for mercy. God, I pray this happens. I pray that your mercy and grace is freely experienced in this place. And I pray that there's a depth to which we now encounter it because we understand the other side of the same coin of your character. The severity of your thirst and quest and your utter commitment to justice. Pray that none of us would be scared into a relationship with you, but that this would be something that prompts us to embrace you for who you are. I thank you for being patient and just the reality that I'm talking about something that I've read about. I'm not talking about something that I've ever experienced, and none of us have, and that's because of your hand. I pray your hand would continue to hold us and guard us.